Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have one of those jam-packed shows for you this week, Cats and Kittens. The question of the week is actually four questions, and yes, there are four answers to go with them. What a shock. We'll also be talking about some exciting new research that plays up a little understood benefit of having trees around, especially in the urban environment. But we also have to take lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Edward, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how you doing?
I am doing just fine, Edward. How are you, sir?
I'm doing okay.
And where is Edward doing okay?
I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, a great town. What can we do for you?
Well, I have these things in my backyard called cicada killers.
Yes, you. Very good. You've identified the creature correctly.
Yes, I managed to capture one and take it to work and then take it to an insect place, and they told me what it was, and these things are menacing.
Well, it's funny. They are, to my mind, one of the most impressive creatures in all of nature. Cicada killers are solitary wasps. They're very large wasps, but if you've seen them in action, and if you have a lot of them, you've seen them in action, you know they're not half as big as the cicadas that they prey on. These female wasps, they hang up in the trees where the cicadas are, and they get a hold of one, and they sting it, and they paralyze it. And then the nature books tell you, and then the female wasp will fly the cicada back to the nest she's prepared in the ground. And I had them one year in my property, and they did not so much fly as plummet. This wasp would take off with this giant cicada and hit the ground and then drag this poor stunned cicada into the hole in the ground, cover it with eggs of her children who would later devour the paralyzed cicada, fill in the hole, and move on. They are amazing creatures. And as you know, if you've had a lot of them in your backyard, they don't sting.
They don't sting?
They don't sting. Humans, you haven't been stung, right?
No, but I've had one chase me inside the house.
You know, it's funny. There are many insects like this that have stingers, but don't waste them on humans, and that's what the cicada killer is. But many people have had the same thing happen with a bumblebee or a carpenter bee. And I wonder if the same situation didn't happen with you in the sense that it was a male, because the males don't have stingers. And
okay,
so when a big insect like that comes and buzzes in your face and is menacing, and, you know, I've even been headbutted by a carpenter bee once, that's all they got. It's all bluff.
Okay. The lawnmower seems to bother them.
Oh, okay. So they're in your lawn.
Yes.
And your lawn is not in good shape, then, I'm going to suggest, Ed.
Well, they're on the outsides of it where I guess there's dry dirt.
Oh, okay. The answer is not to have that dry dirt. Think of yourself as a cicada-killing wasp. You've got all this work to do. You got to lug this huge creature. You got to dig a hole. You got to go catch the thing. You got to lug it back. Then you got to fill in the hole. So you're looking for easy pickings.
Yeah.
If you sow some seed to cover those bare areas at the edge, or there's even really interesting ground covers, things like creeping thyme that you could grow at the edge. And
okay,
anything you grow there, if you do a good job and it covers the bare earth, they're not going to come back. First of all, these are creatures that are not going to reuse those original holes. You know, they will be born in your backyard, the new ones. But especially
okay,
if there are not a lot of cicadas next year and you don't give them any loose dirt opportunities, they're going to go lay their eggs someplace else.
Okay, sounds good.
Did you have a lot of cicadas this year as well?
No, not a lot, but it seems like the cicada killers come back every August.
because there's always been that strip of bare dirt on the outside, right?
Yeah.
It's like when we go down the shore every year, the same place, you know, we went with our parents and we took our kids. But you can close the motel by covering that area with mulch or, you know, laying something down over top of it for a single season or filling it in with plantings. Whatever you want to do to break the cycle, they won't come back after that.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, Edward, good luck, sir.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. Where is Sarah Good?
I'm calling from Foggy Island in Portland, Oregon.
Is it actually Foggy Island, or it's just an island that's...
Foggy Island.
It's called that?
Yes.
And it lives up to its name all the time, doesn't it?
Yes.
So how does that change your outlook on life when you really are seeing, like, three-quarters of your days through a shroud?
Well, you know, a lot of coffee.
Yeah, I guess. That's why Portland and Seattle are so famous for brewing up the good stuff. All right. What can we do for Foggy Sarah?
Well, we just moved to this house, and I want to kind of get a garden prepped for spring planting. And the thing is, we have a lot of deer, so I want to kind of prevent them from coming in. So I was wondering, do I need a fence, or what can I do preventatively to keep the deer out?
Oh, I thought you said beer. I thought you said we're trying to start a garden, but we have a lot of beer. We just can't seem to get it. Well, you need a lot of beer, actually, because you guys have slugs that are the size of small vehicles, right?
Yes.
Well, the first answer for deer is the only guaranteed way is to erect a fence that's 11 inches taller than Shaquille O'Neal. One of the, quote, invisible deer fences. These are not as expensive as people think, and they're not ugly. True deer fencing, which is actually 8 feet tall, is made of a specialized netting. Well, I mean, and you're constantly in fire. You can't see anything anyway. This will help you from, like, walking off a cliff. You'll go into this net instead of wandering off your property and never finding your home again. But it is invisible from most angles, so it's not like you're living inside a prison camp or anything like that. The second most effective way to keep deer away is to have a dog.
And you have a dog.
What do you got?
A lab.
Okay, a lab would be an excellent dog. Now, is he allowed to roam around outside?
Yes.
Have you had deer problems yet, or they're just eyeing you through the mist?
No, we've seen them in the evenings, like coming through the yard, so.
Okay, is the dog restrained in any way on your property so that for?
Yeah, it's fenced in.
And the deer just jump over that fence?
No, they just jump over that fence.
Okay. Were you to open the door and let the dog out at these times?
Yeah.
And you do that?
Yes.
You're training the deer that this place is too much trouble. You're actually doing one of the best things you can do. There was a researcher who was studying different types of fencing and was being unsuccessful because one of the grad students had a big floppy Weimaraner he brought with him every day. And the dog kept chasing the deer away until no deer would come near the test area. So we know from research that dogs are the second most effective. The more your dog is outside, the more the deer are startled by the dog, the more the deer will avoid your property. The other thing that works very well for me is a motion-activated sprinkler. This is something you buy once. You can find them online. The original one is called the Scarecrow. And it comes with a stake. You put it in the ground. I found it to be more effective to knock like a 5-foot pole in the ground and put the stake in that so the sprinkler is up high. And you put a 9-volt battery in the head. It has a motion sensor inside. You hook up your garden hose to it. Turn your garden hose on full blast and nothing happens till something breaks the beam. And then the motion-activated sprinkler throws a couple of cups of cold water at them. Well, nothing really likes that. Nothing gets used to it, but nothing is harmed by it either. So I have found it very effective, especially in training the deer. That concept is really important. Give them a really bad experience when they are young, when the new ones are trying to find territory, new rhododendrons to eat. Give them a bad experience on your property, and they will not come back. And that dog is your best hope. Brush him outside, have him outside whenever they come by, let him loose, and he will train the deer in your area that your house is too much trouble.
Good.
All right, Sarah, see, you solved your own problem.
Yeah.
You were
just, thanks a lot.
Just a little foggy from the island. You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will answer your garden questions live and in person when I host the annual Empty Bowl Benefit Dinner for the Homeless at the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Chestnut Hill, PA, on Wednesday evening, November 19th. You get to buttonhole me, eat all the soup you want, take away a handmade bowl, and help homeless families. Such a mitzvah! But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to answer more questions about compost than you thought possible and take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Grand American Tours. In July of 2015, Mike McGrath will be hosting a Viking river cruise through the gardens of Provence. More at 800-423-0247 or grandamericantours.com. And by MoleZap and AntZap. Their OMRI-listed organic, child and pet-safe mole and ant mound eliminator are designed to leave no runoff or chemical residue. More at AntZap.com and MoleZap.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, four questions about compost. And yes, because we knew you'd be counting, four answers as well. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. As promised, it is time to welcome our special guest, R.J. Laverne, an arborist and urban forester for the Davy Tree Expert Company. He joins us through the kind auspices of WKSU at Kent State. R.J., welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you. Your specialty, the reason you're on the show, is you are studying how changes in the urban canopy affect essentially people's mental and physical health, correct?
Yes, and there's a whole interesting list of benefits that urban trees provide to us city dwellers that goes far beyond the intuitive things that we think about, like beneficial shade They're also helping to cleanse the air that we breathe by absorbing some of the pollutants. They're reducing the amount of stormwater that reaches our storm sewers and ultimately the water treatment plants. And then you get into these fascinating social benefits. Some of them are pretty obvious, like if we have parks and green spaces in our cities, that will encourage more people to get outside and possibly to exercise. But simply being able to see a green space out your window can have beneficial effects on our stress levels and can even affect our ability to concentrate and stay on task.
And when these lists are made up of livable cities, the most livable cities in America, amount of green space gets quite a large percentage of the final tally.
That's exactly right. It turns out that when you have green spaces in neighborhoods where people can congregate, neighbors see one another more often. They communicate with one another more often. They start to recognize whose children belongs to which parents. And the more that the neighbors communicate and the more that they find comfort in the company of one another, the stronger the social networks are that are built in neighborhoods and throughout communities.
Now, does this dovetail into your current research? Because obviously, if there's a park across the street, that's something you're looking at as a young parent buying a house or something like that, because the obvious reasons. But I'm sensing that your newest research is looking at the opposite, that if there is no greenery outside, I can see how people would want to stay closed up in their house or their apartment.
That's true. The first idea came, wouldn't it be great if we had a neighborhood or a community that had no trees at all, and we measured all sorts of things in that barren landscape. And then overnight, we were able to bring in hundreds of mature large trees, and we planted them, and we were able to measure very quickly environmental effects, economic effects.
We do that every year at the Philadelphia Flower Show. We start we start with an empty convention center, and you talk about your noise and your stress levels, and then 2.5 weeks later, it's like the Elysian Fields.
Yes, that's right. Well, as you experienced at the garden show, it takes an awful lot of work and a lot of expense, and it's not very practical to move large trees around. So I'm taking advantage of a very nasty insect pest who's allowing me to look at that question from 180 degrees about. So instead of starting with no trees and then adding trees, I'm starting in communities that have trees and unfortunately are losing those trees very quickly due to the invasive insect called the emerald ash borer.
Nasty piece of work.
Indeed. The benefit that that I'm able to find from this tragedy as a researcher is that since I know and I can easily find out where all of the ash trees are in a community before the insect starts killing the trees off, then I have a very clear picture as to where I should focus my before loss of trees measurements. I make a series of sound recordings throughout the four seasons in neighborhoods that have lots of ash trees. And then after those ash trees have been infested by the beetle and the city comes in and removes all of those damaged and dead trees, then I make the same type of sound recordings after the trees are gone.
And
I compare the two.
And you measure decibels and things like that.
Yes. And the decibels that you refer to are a measure of the sound intensity or the loudness. What I'm really interested in is in how the mix of sounds change. So, for example, in a neighborhood that has many trees, you might expect to hear lots of birdsong, at least in the spring and the summertime. And in the late summer and fall, you might expect to hear insects like cicadas and katydids and so on. Well, as the tree canopy is removed, it's likely that we'll hear fewer and fewer of those sounds that come from living organisms other than human beings.
And, of course, it's obvious that the trees are also habitats for some of the prettiest, most joyous noises in the world.
Yes, and certainly the absence of trees will do more than simply allow mechanical sounds and urban noise to reach us. It's more than a loss of the noise absorption that goes away as the trees go away, but it's the mix and the quality of the sounds. Many of these sounds that on a subconscious level can reassure us, can lower our stress levels, can increase our ability to pay attention during a long day. There's all sorts of levels that the soundscape coming from the environment that surrounds us impacts how we perceive the environment and how we perform as human beings.
Have you been able to quantify blood pressure, stress levels, concentration levels?
I haven't approached that yet. I'm right in the middle of my collection of sound samples before and after trees are removed. But the second part of my study that will be coming up early next year won't look at the physiology signs like blood pressure and breathing rate, but rather I'll be looking at what's called directed attention. And that's the strength of your ability to concentrate. So as you're listening to me speak right now, part of your brain is working to pay attention to that. And yet there's probably another little portion of your brain that would rather be thinking about what you're going to do tonight or the bills that need to be paid. So the strength of your directed attention in a lot of cases will affect the efficiency with which you work. So I will be playing these sound recordings, both before the trees have been removed and after the trees have been removed, for as many volunteers as I can round up. And I will randomly assign them to listening to these sound recordings. And then while they're listening, I'll ask them to take very simple tests for directed attention.
And I presume that they're doing this with, at one point, natural sounds in the background and at the other point, unmuted city sounds in the background.
Yes. I think I'll start out with very distinct sounds. I've made measurements in Midtown Manhattan and in Central Park, and they are very much different.
You think?
Quite a bit. But eventually I will move the sounds closer and closer, and the changes will be quite subtle. I'm doing most of my research work in the Chicago metropolitan area. So some people will be listening to a neighborhood street that had trees in September of last year, and other people will be listening to that exact same space on the same day this year, but after the trees have been removed. And the differences in the soundscape might be pretty subtle, but I suspect that those differences may be enough to be revealed in these tests for directed attention.
Well, you have caught our attention. You've given us some of these sounds. And what we'll do, we'll put these sounds up on our website to kind of ride along with this interview so that people can sample what we're talking about. Continue your research. We're going to be on your tail. And we will have you back on because this is, even for someone like I who's been in this business 30 years, this is helping put trees in an even better light in my head, which I didn't think was possible. R.J. Laverne is an arborist and urban forester for the Davy Tree Expert Company. He joined us today from WKSU in Kent State. R.J., thanks so much for being with us today. I've tremendously enjoyed speaking with you.
And it has certainly been my pleasure, and I greatly appreciate your interest in this topic.
All right. Good day.
Thank you.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rich, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing good, Rich. How are you?
Very good today.
And where is Rich very good?
Monroeville, New Jersey.
Which is what part of the state?
It's about three, 4 miles south of Glassboro on Route 55, heading towards the shore.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. All right. What can we do for Rich in Monroeville?
I just tried something on my own about 4 years ago. So it was 2010. I just like super fresh avocados.
Mm-hmm.
I took the seed, put toothpicks in the side of it, put it in some water for months. They root it. They sprout it with stems. Now I have about 3 foot tall in containers, you know, like a 10-gallon container.
Oh, good.
They're 4 years old. I bring them in and out every year. I'm just wondering how much longer, if I'll ever get anything off it. If not, I don't know what else to do.
Well, do you enjoy them as houseplants? Especially, very few people can brag that they grew their own houseplants from seed. That's,
That's yeah. I do that often, but they are getting big because I have transplanted them into larger pots.
Right.
Do you think they can survive out if I treat them like I would a fig tree?
The chances are really grim.
Okay.
There are three different kind of avocado basic plants from different parts of the country. And so, first of all, we don't know what you started from. You certainly don't remember what the sticker said was the country of origin. But guess what? It probably wasn't the United States.
No. I'm sure it wasn't. It was so the ones that are in the big basket and you root through them.
The basic answer is taking them in and out. They can make excellent house plants. Do you like them? Are they nice and full? Are they lively? Do they make good house plants for you?
They do. I'll be honest with you. I definitely didn't prune them correctly. So I could make one a house plant if I wanted to. But I really wanted to see if I can grow an avocado. That was the whole goal.
They need 7 to 9 months of summer to fruit. Mm. Something you don't get in New Jersey very often.
Right.
And even then, I was reading up on avocados the other day in one of Lee Reich's fruit books. The flowers are weird. And in addition to the three places they come from, there's what's called a type A and type B. And if I understand this correctly, the flowers change sex, like overnight. Type A maybe opens up male, and then the next day it'll have turned into a female flower. Type B does the reverse, and maybe I've gotten the sexes reversed. I just think type A would be a male flower to start.
Right.
But the pollination is very complex. Now, in the tropics or on the West Coast or down in southern Florida, it turns out that's not an issue. Because when these puppies get to be a certain age, that's another issue with yours. When they flower, the plants are just covered with flowers. So there's, it's not like they're inconspicuous or anything. What Lee says, people who want to do what you're doing, and he actually encourages it, is you start your avocado from seed the way you did. And then when it gets to be a certain age, like 2 years old, you actually graft a known variety onto the top. In other words, you cut off the top of your plant, you make a little V shape in the trunk, and then you would insert the stem of a known variety that was the best one possible for exotic home growers who are trying to grow these things outside of their range. And then you just take care of that grafted area until it totally heals up. And then you've got a tree that if you can give it some artificial light, some help, really have a long, hot summer, that's a tree that you may actually see a couple of pieces of fruit on. Your trees are not going to get covered in flowers. They're not going to fruit. They are what they are. And they can be very pretty plants. And I would honestly suggest that you read up on the three types.
Sure.
You would never get fruit almost from any tree that you started from seed at 4 years. That's why people buy these saplings that are 5 or 6 feet tall. Those trees are already 4 or 5 years old. So, and then it takes those trees 3 or 4 years to bear good fruit in the home environment. So you'd be looking at year 10. I think, before even the miracle of Fatima could occur in New Jersey.
All right. I'm going to take your suggestion and make something out of what I had.
You will find good suppliers of what are called scions online. That's the top part that you would graft into your little tree. They'll send it to you with all kinds of directions. In the future, don't be so aggressive at potting it up. A lot of times you can train these trees to be somewhat smaller by restricting the size of their container.
I did realize that they are going to grow taller by putting them in there. I was hoping that somebody would tell me they'll survive outside, but I'm not going to go any bigger than what I have now. And in the house, they'll stand about 6 feet tall if I continue to let them grow. So it'll be a nice little corner piece if it works out.
Exactly. Just enjoy them. You did good.
I appreciate the info, Mike. I'm going to listen to you every Saturday.
All right, Rich. Thank you, sir. Take care.
Take care. Have a good day now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that PHS, the people who put on the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show, and NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farmers Association, are teaming up to offer accreditation in organic lawn care in an exciting course that will run from December 8th through the 11th in Philadelphia. But don't go looking for how you can earn credits towards saving the planet at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to answer more questions about compost than you thought possible and take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Grand American Tours. In July of 2015, Mike McGrath will be hosting a Viking river cruise through the gardens of Provence. More at 800-423-0247 or grandamericantours.com. And by MoleZap and AntZap, their OMRI-listed organic, child and pet-safe mole and ant mound eliminator are designed to leave no runoff or chemical residue. More at AntZap.com and MoleZap.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to four, count them, four questions and answers about fall leaves and compost making. That's right, the question of the week is four questions of the week. No waiting. Well, actually, you have to wait through a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at once. 888-346-9499. Alan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, so good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Alan. Where are you, sir?
Easton, Pennsylvania.
All right, what can we do for you, sir?
I have ornamentally, I grew some herbs on my garden deck.
Right.
And I have, I think, three sages and two different basils. I have some oregano and thyme, all in containers. And during the summer, I've been, even though ornamental, I've been taking some, of course, and flavoring my foods and using it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But my question was, it's almost near frost time. how can I save the leaves and save whatever I need to of the plant so I can be using it during the winter? How do I dry it? Should I wash it and just dry it? Should I freeze it? Should I read somewhere, microwave it. Should I heat it to dry it? I just want to save it for my spices and my flavoring for the winter.
Well, if you've been doing some research, you probably read that basil does not dry well, right?
Right.
When you dry basil, it tastes terrible compared to when it is fresh. You know, basil, you could bring inside and you could extend it if you have like a bright sunny window or you'd be willing to set up a shop light and have the plants right underneath it.
Yeah, I really don't have any capability of that in my house. The other ones, the sages I got, I went to a home center and they have three different kinds of sages. And I've had wonderful sage all summer. Would I be better off drying them, way I do with my basil?
First, I have a question. Have any of the sages flowered?
Yes. One especially has really gone to flower.
Yes. So those leaves, try them fresh, but generally when that happens, the leaves don't taste nearly as good anymore.
I'm just kind of afraid of that.
Oddly enough, the best time to preserve these leaves is throughout the season.
Mm-hmm.
When they're young, when the plants are young, they're putting on a lot of leaves, pulling off perfect leaves is going to stimulate the plant to produce more. And if you want to delay the flowering, especially with basil, which loves to go to flower, you keep pinching off the very top of the plant. And that'll cause it to branch out and get bushier. It'll also prevent the flower buds from developing. And that'll give you your best flavor. You can go out and buy inexpensive dehydrators. And once you get started with these, you'll never go back. I grow a lot of garlic, a lot of hardneck garlic. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't keep well over the winter. So I chop a lot of the smaller cloves up. I dry them in my food dryer. And then I grind them up and make my own garlic powder.
So, I've seen those dryers, but since I have never had use for it before, I have the amount of herbs I have right now. But,
right. Do you have electric or gas for your oven?
Do I have electric oven? I have.
Set it at its lowest possible setting, like 110, 120. Dry them in there until they're nice and crinkly. And then the important thing is that you have Old Spice jars ready that you've washed out and everything that are clean and dry. Then when you store them, make sure that, you know, when you buy vitamins and get new shoes, they have those desiccating pouches or containers. Mm-hmm. Save all of those and put one of those into each spice jar as you put your spices away, and that'll continue the drying process and, you know, give you a little edge against them picking up moisture from the air.
Okay, wouldn't have thought of that. Okay, that sounds reasonable.
That's how I keep my garlic powder from caking up.
I think I will buy this weekend before it does start freezing up here. I think I'll pluck off my leaves and get them in the oven and see what happens.
And next year, make it a year-long process. The earlier in the season you do this, the better tasting your dried herbs are going to be.
Yeah, okay. I probably will. Probably will.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Hey, Mike, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Appreciate your help.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Carl, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you, Mike. It's nice to talk with you.
It's great to speak with you, Carl. Where are you, sir?
I live in Gilbertsville, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you?
Well, I just moved last month, and I'll tell you, I had some raised beds that I put in the backyard. I had two large ones. They were about 4x8, and I put them in the ground 3 or 4 years ago. And I did the square foot gardening method.
Okay.
So I had some really nice, really light soil in there. The first year, everything did pretty well. Second year, things did pretty well. Third year, I started noticing something odd. And this year, because we moved, I had to take them out of the ground. And when I took them out of the ground, I realized that they were completely infused with tree roots.
Right. And
now, I was trying not to turn the soil too much, so I didn't notice it was all these tree roots. And once I actually tore everything up, I realized they were coming right underneath, from underneath the weed barrier, to, from, you know, a tree line maybe 12 feet away.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's very common. So you took your garden with you.
Well, I wanted to, but we're renting right now, and so I found a good home for them. And so
you took your garden from the old house and you've put it in storage.
Right, basically.
Oh, great. So that is a common problem, especially if you can see the trees.
Right.
I just did a whole bunch of interviews for a tree story. And when I was talking to one of the arborists, we were talking about root systems. And I was going, I've always told people to expect that the roots of the tree go out as far laterally as the furthest branch up top. And that's a good way to visualize how far the roots go out. And
right.
In the past, actually, a listener yelled at me, said, oh, no, they don't go out nearly that far. So I've never gone further than that. But he said, no, in their experience, the root system will often go out 2 to 3 times further than the canopy. So it's almost like if you can see trees, then this is probably an issue.
I mean, what do you do? Can you put, like, you know, steel down? I mean, what do you put there?
Well, my advice for building raised beds is you start out with your flat surface, you bust it up so there's good drainage, but then you lay your frames down on top. But actually, before you lay the frames down, you put down a single layer of cardboard all over everything, including the lanes. And then you fill your frames with a nice 50-50 topsoil and compost mix, however you're going to fill them. Scatter wood chips or something to keep weeds down in the lanes between the plants. But if you think that tree roots are coming in, then the only thing you can do during the season is to get a tool that will go down into the ground around the edges of the raised beds and keep the roots at bay. It would not be safe, but someone who had made sure that there's no rocks in the soil, that everything was nice and clean, and who was interested in cowboy gardening, might consider using a chainsaw to go along the edge. If your soil's really nice and loose, you could actually drag a machete along there.
Right.
And
right.
While it might not slice through a root that's gotten by you for a couple of years, it would stop you. And then you would realize something's coming into your bed and you have to dig in that spot. But you're absolutely right. Once raised beds are in place and they're built the way they're supposed to be, as you did, no wider than 4 feet, you really aren't supposed to be tilling the soil in them or messing around with it. But even that would not stop tree roots. The way to do that is to constantly edge around the inside of the frames, but it's not going to happen in every situation. It was just your beds were in the path of least resistance. Maybe even the reason you sited your beds where you did made the place a good spot for those tree roots to crawl towards.
Right.
It's not the kind of thing that happens all the time. So when you get a chance to garden again, I would put this not at the top of my worries. But again, a machete is a great tool for a gardener to have. There's that.
You know, I sincerely wanted to buy one this year.
That oh, yeah. Really, it's a manly tool. There's a risk of personal danger every time you use it. They're great for clearing brush, but there's probably no better tool for just going around the inside of your raised bed frames early in the season, making sure there's no early shenanigans going on, but you're not disturbing the soil in the middle.
Right, good, okay.
All right, so you have my permission to buy a machete. Isn't this the best call ever?
It is. This is going to be great.
All right, Carl, be careful.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which this week is a quartet of questions on how to make and or buy the best black gold. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started running with question number one.
Okay, Mike. Larry, who, quote, lives on 11 acres of East Tennessee woods in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains, writes, I'm brand new to composting and wondering if the leaves of all tree species are equally effective and safe for turning into garden gold. Most of our leaves are from poplar trees, but we also have oak, maple, sweet gum, hickory, black walnut, and, God help us, mimosa. Are there any leaves I should avoid putting in the compost bin?
Not really. The only really problematic leaves are black walnut, which contain juglone, a naturally occurring compound that can inhibit the growth of or just plain kill certain plants, even after they're made into compost. But experts assure me that even black walnut leaves are fine to include if they only make up a small percentage of the pile. The most important thing is the shredding. Whole leaves mat down and take forever to compost, but leaves that are mowed, go through a shredder or a leaf blower set on reverse, become compost much more quickly.
Mike in Green Bay writes, I've been flat earth gardening, but I'm ready to take the plunge into raised beds. I've listened for a while and think I understand how to construct the beds, the proper dimensions, etc., and intend to use a 50-50 mix of soil and compost to fill them. I'd like to make a few this fall so they'll be ready when the growing season starts. But will the compost still have its nutrients next spring, or will they wash out with rain, snow melt, etc.?
Well, fall is an excellent time to construct raised beds. Just remember to make them no wider than 4 feet so you can always reach into the centers without stepping on that light, loose soil. Now, if this question was from a warmer climate, I'd suggest equipping the beds with hoops and row covers and using that compost right away to grow salad greens and such this winter. But in Wisconsin, your best bet is to cover the finished beds with 2 inches of shredded leaves to keep as many of the nutrients intact as possible over winter, and to prevent weeds from moving in.
You had a long email exchange with Pamela in Penn Valley, PA, who began by telling you that her knockout roses really suffered this year. You explained that knockouts recently seem to have been infected with a rose virus at unusually high rates, and then discovered she was using wood mulch, which weakens roses and makes them much more prone to disease and pests. She thanked you for the information, promised to switch to compost mulch, and wrote, "One more question. Is any particular type of compost best to use?"
It's a great question. First, we're talking about, quote, yard waste compost made from fall leaves and ideally very little else. We are not talking about composted manure or any compost that looks, feels, or smells off in any way.
Right. You call this the duck test.
Yeah. If it looks like dark, rich soil, smells like dark, rich soil, and feels like dark, rich soil, it must be a duck. I mean good compost. Hey, lady, you want to buy a duck?
Not from you. Your compost, yes. A duck, no. Now behave. As we move on to Stephen in Oklahoma City, who writes, in the past, I have mostly bagged and composted my grass clippings, especially in the fall, as I get boatloads of leaves and need to fortify them with, quote, greens. But I heeded your lawn care advice and now mulch all my clippings into the lawn instead. It seems to have helped my lawn, but last year's leaves have still not completely composted as a result. What should I do? Which method is more earth-friendly?
Grass clippings should always be mulched back into the lawn, period. They're 10% nitrogen by weight, which makes them a perfect year-round supplemental feeding for turf. Mulched clippings also increase biodiversity at the soil line, which helps to prevent and or eliminate thatch. And if you are foolish enough to use chemical herbicides on your lawn, compost made with your clippings could kill any plant that is not a lawn grass. Now, to make any leaves compost faster, be sure to shred them really well. And if you want and or need to further accelerate the process, mix in some spent coffee grounds. They're a much more powerful wet green than even grass clippings, and using them doesn't starve your lawn. You could also use horse manure or poultry manure from birds that aren't medicated or confined.
I can understand the medicated part, and I would never personally buy anything chicken-related that wasn't free-range. But I'm curious as to why you wouldn't use their manure and compost if the chickens haven't been fed antibiotics or growth hormones.
One night at a medical conference dinner, somebody asked the natural physician Andy Weil, "What's the worst food you can eat?" And he quickly answered, "Anything cooked by an unhappy person." I feel the same way about chickens. I only want happy poop in my piles. Well, that sure was a captivatingly clever quartet of Q&As about compost now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to the answers to all your other compost questions, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to make my ducks depressed if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your charge report, your wretched refuse team, which hurts our garden short, at garden@whyy.org. And if you send us that email,
please tell us where you live.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's webpage, but not web-footed, wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at our You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Veganistic Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Peter the Magic Christian is, well, he's sick this week. Come to think of it, I haven't seen much of our hired hand, Matt Pudecki, since the leaves started falling. Perhaps he is ill as well. Or maybe he's just not up yet. I'm tanned, rested, and ready, Mike McGrath, and I'll be sure to wear ear protection when I shred up all my fall leaves so that I can hear you when I see you again next week. Is it a wicked weed or a delicately pretty and delectably edible ground cover? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what you can do when chickweed comes to play. Plus your fabulous phone calls.